Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Power of Agencies and Takings Claim Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 15, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Coons v. St. John's River Management District. This case raises two questions regarding the power of land use agencies with respect to development permits. First, whether a denial of a permit for failure to comply with government conditions constitutes a taking of property under the Fifth Amendment. And second, whether certain nexus and proportionality tests set forth by the Supreme Court apply in such circumstances. To discuss the case, we have Richard Epstein, professor at New York University School of Law and professor emeritus at the University of Chicago Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hello, everybody. This is Richard A. Epstein, and I'm speaking from the Hoover Institution at Palo Alto, and the topic of discussion today is the oral argument that took place on January 15, 2013, in the great case of Coye Kunz Petitioner against the St. John's River Water Management District respondent. The case itself involves the very vexed doctrine of unconstitutional conditions, and it arises out of a set of facts which sort of indicate the power of the government to deal with land use regulation when the question comes to matters of what are commonly called today environmental mitigation. And this particular case began in 1994, and our friend Kunz applied for a permit which would allow him to dredge and fill with sand about 3.7 acres of a 14.2 acre parcel. And the dispute arose from the fact that some 3.4 acres of this land were wetlands, and some of them were small amount were uplands adjacent to wetlands, which are treated like wetlands under Florida law. And for 19 years, from 1994 to the present, the question involved in this particular case is what could the water district or the river water management district demand from Mr. Kunz for the privilege of developing his wetlands for private profit? And the way the issue turns out to play out is as follows. The basic doctrine which underlies this particular dispute is that the state is said to have an unquestioned environmental mandate which allows it to demand that any person who develops one portion of wetlands purchase or otherwise repair other parts of wetlands for the benefit of the public at large. And the theory is clearly you have to mitigate a harm that you have caused, and the only way that you can do that is to fix some facilities which exist elsewhere, or in fact, dedicate some portion of your land, or buy the government land somewhere else. And in this particular case, the negotiations broke down because what Kunz insisted was that the only mitigation that he could be required to do involved a parcel of land that was subject to the development. And the position that the water district took was, no, that is not going to be sufficient because our ratios say that for every acre that you develop, you have to set aside 3, or maybe it's 5, or maybe 10 acres of land, which will be wetlands forever. And there simply is not enough land on the plot that you have to do this. Now, one of the possibilities, of course, was that Kunz could decide to shrink the size of his development project to a quarter of its size so that he might be able to dedicate the rest of the land for protection. But the obvious implication is the moment you shrink it, it's not going to be economically viable. And so the question then is there a quote-unquote taking of the land to the extent that there's an impasse in the negotiations between the two parties such that he does not get to build the land? And one of the arguments that was made by the water management district in this particular case was, you know, if you really haven't gone through to the limits, we haven't taken anything because you just haven't done anything. And so therefore, you cannot protest what has happened in this particular case. And the other argument they made was, look, we are really extremely reasonable people. We gave you 5 or 6 different alternatives about the way in which you could mitigate this particular loss, and you just stuck your jaw out and refused to make a deal over any one of them. We're the guys who are flexible and virtuous. You're just simply rigid and artificial in the way in which you deal with the subject. And so that's the way in which the case comes up to the Supreme Court. And right out of the box, it's quite clear that our friend Kunz is going to be running into some degree of difficulty, because the implicit major premise is the one which was that environmental mitigation is a well-accepted and thoroughly sound social practice. So Justice Ginsburg, in the opening of the argument, sort of demands that he kind of concede this particular point, and then the only question is who's being reasonable or not reasonable in the way in which these kinds of negotiations start to take place. And since they showed an immense amount of flexibility, and he showed a regrettable lack of flexibility and an uncommon amount of rigidity, the basic inclination was that he's the guy who is wearing the dark hat. The government is, in fact, in the virtuous position, so that this particular situation ought to be allowed to go forward without there being any compensation at all. The conversation then also has to turn to the interaction between two major doctrinal lines of cases. One of them is the so-called Penn Central line, and the other is the Dolan and Nolan line, the first dealing with regulatory takings, and the second dealing with unconstitutional conditions. And with respect to the first of these, there was a lot of sentiment, particularly from Justice Breyer, saying, look, we've already solved these problems. We have our wonderful Penn Central case. And given the fact that we can now figure out whether or not this land use restriction is justified by some environmental concern, we know how to do the balancing. Why are we even worrying about unconstitutional conditions at all? And the implicit assumption is that the Penn Central test actually makes some sense. I think the correct response to that is it is a walking, talking, screaming disaster, and nobody has ever been able to figure out how to apply it in a coherent fashion. Nobody indeed knows how to draw the clear line between a land use restriction on the one hand and the taking of air rights on the other, which was in fact the very issue which was at stake in Penn Central itself. So the case that supposedly introduces the distinction between physical and regulatory casing is a case in which the distinction itself turns out not to be clear. Then the other side of the line turns out to be the unconstitutional conditions line, and the basic intuition here is whenever the state exercises its permit power, it can attach some but not any kind of condition that it likes. And further on in the argument, when it turns out that the Supreme Court was questioning the lawyer, Mr. Wolfson, for the St. John's River Water Management District, they kept on saying, well, you know, we want to have a new football stadium in town. Can we tell our friend Kuntz that he's entitled to build this property only if he gives an extraordinary amount of contribution with respect to the football stadium? And he looked a little bit befuddled, at least he sounded a little bit befuddled, but the basic answer was, of course, no. And the reason that the justices asked that course was that they wanted to make it very clear that you could not, in effect, attach any old condition to any particular grant, the implication clearly being that there is some application for the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions. The question then is, on which side of the line does this particular case start to fall? And at this point, Justice Scalia became fairly active in the argument because he was obviously concerned about the relationship of this case with his own rather ambitious but I think ultimately failed effort to put some kind of coherence into the doctrine of unconstitutional conditions in his famous decision in Dolan. And what he said, in effect, is there had to be some kind of essential nexus between the condition that's imposed and the malady that is sought to be remedied. And in that particular case, there was no evidence whatsoever in Dolan that the lateral easement that the California Coastal Commission demanded out of friend Dolan so that people could walk back and forth across it had anything to do with the way in which people might want to be able to see the Pacific Ocean while driving along the Pacific Coast Highway, which is on the far side of the Dolan's plot. Rather than Nolan's plot. So you have this kind of complication going on, and it turns out that if you take this fitness test, Justice Scalia has to switch sides in this particular case. What he will turn out to say is as follows. Look, at this particular point, the objective that the government has is environmental mitigation. You've conceded that that's legitimate. The thing that they're requiring you to do is to mitigate the environmental harm from your development. There is now a perfect congruence between the remedy that's imposed and the evil that has been subjected to. And so under the Nolan-Dolan test that we've talked about before, what will clearly happen in these particular cases is, in fact, that this condition would be regarded as proper and you will lose the case. My own sense is, having gone through this whole argument, is that will turn out, with respect to this particular case, to be the winning line. The second point, I think, that makes this case credible on this point of view, at least, is the way in which it influences the kind of bargaining games. One of the things that is often forgotten is the rather thoughtful dissent that Justice Brennan gave in the Nolan case in which he says, you apply this doctrine of unconstitutional conditions and stop what's going on through bargaining, it means that what's going to happen is these guys won't be able to get their permits, and you're going to ruin the course of development rather than advance it. And in this particular case, the argument has some salience. What's going on here, of course, is they want to get their pound of flesh, that is the water district, out of this situation. And if the guy doesn't have enough land to give from his own property, the only way he can mitigate is to go off-site. So if you truncate the set of options, they're sure to deny the development permit. And so therefore, according to Justice Brennan, we have to become great believers in the doctrine of freedom of contract and let these people hash it all out. So that's the way in which the argument starts to go. If you actually read the transcript, there's a certain surreal aspect about the whole thing, because what they do, unfortunately, is to ignore the elephant in the closet, which is the question of whether or not the doctrine of environmental mitigation makes the slightest bit of sense as a way of dealing with property relationships between individuals and the government. So the question that was asked at the beginning by Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor is that we take environmental mitigation as being an unquestioned social practice should receive this answer. This is one of the more dangerous practices that has ever developed in the environmental movement, and we should stop it forthwith and go back to conventional takings doctrine. Well, how, you might ask, will this particular situation work? And the answer to that question is, again, pretty simple and straightforward. If it turns out that the government thinks that the land in question is worth a great deal as a wetland, what they should do is simply condemn it and take money from the public treasury in order to pay for that particular condemnation. And I will bet you dollars to donuts, if you figured out what the fair market value of the land in its raw state was for development, the willingness on the part of any local government to pay that man an amount which would cover his particular losses would be close to zero. That's exactly what happened in the famous case of Lucas against the South Carolina Coastal Council, when it turned out that they were forced to pay for the land because they left him no particular use. They sold the whole thing off again because it turned out nobody, but nobody, even in local government, wants to spend $500,000 in order to keep a perfectly sensible piece of developable land idle. So my guess is that they would never do it, and that's exactly the right result that you want. Because what happens is the takings clause, properly understood, is the following situation. It says that the landowner has a series of private uses, and the government has a series of public uses. And we have to try to find out which set of uses are going to be more valuable. What the just compensation provision says is there's now a price schedule out there that the government has to pay. It may be tricky to work out in some cases, but certainly not in all. And if, in fact, you know what the price for the development rights is, and it's worth more to you in the public, you'll raise the money through taxes and buy it. And if it's not, you won't. And remember, like in markets, a price system has part of its greatest triumphs by preventing those transactions that should never take place in the first place. So that when somebody comes back and says there'll be fewer environmental protection applications with respect to wetlands, the response to that question should be, congratulations. If you set the prices correct, it turns out that there are some purchases that are not worth making. And if the government wants to repair other sites or if it wants to buy other sites, it can take the same dollars that it would foolishly spend on the property owned by Mr. Koontz and would send that off to buy those other lands out there or make those other kinds of repairs. So it has a very powerful disciplining function. Now, compared to that, think of what happens when you claim that there's an environmental easement over everybody's property. The whole environmental easement, because that's what in effect they're claiming, is a giant, legislatively determined, judicially sanctioned taking of everybody's property to the extent that you can only now develop in ways that do not involve the nuisance law with the blessing, benediction, and approval of the government. Where on earth do they get that power? I've studied a lot of law going back to Roman times and modern times. There's not the slightest hint in any private law situation of anybody ever having an environmental easement. So if all of Koontz's neighbors together said, you know, we really don't want you to develop that wetland because we think it's just wonderful for the community, they could not simply vote amongst themselves to stop it. They would have to pay him. And even then, if they're just private parties, they can only get it with his consent. The government can override the holdout problem, but it certainly ought not to be able to override the payment problem, which is an interest in this case. So what happens is we have to figure out, if we're going to give this easement, who buys and who sells. Well, at this particular point, the choices that are given are not a sign of the soundness of the government's position, but of the utter corruptibility of the particular process. There is no baseline from which they bargain. They can say, oh, you know, we really think we'd like 3 acres of fresh land for you to develop this one. And then somebody else could say, why 3? Why not 2? Why not 4? Why not 10? And if all you're going to do is to say, what you have to do in these things is to split the difference, well, what will happen is that the water district will simply move its goalposts further out. So the spread between them is enormous. Instead of getting 6 acres, you can now get 10 or 20 or 40. So there's this complete indeterminacy, this long period, and by the time this particular situation is done, you have no idea of whether or not you've met the essential condition with respect to a sound government action. Namely, whether or not the property which has been taken to the state is in fact worth more in public or in private hands. Because the price mechanism now is the government says, I'll give you your money or your life. And, you know, you could pick whichever one you want. I'll take my life. Fine, then we'll take your money. That's what robbers do. And robbers give people all sorts of choices. The point is what they do is they give them a choice amongst 10 things, all of which they're entitled to as of right. And they're saying, look, we're very generous. We're only going to take 2 of those things. You can choose which 2 we would like to give you. So once you understand that the way in which this thing works out is, in fact, to create perpetual posturing, bluffing, strategic negotiations that have nothing whatsoever to do with the central question of the environmental mission, what the Supreme Court should do is to sit down and rethink its entire environmental jurisprudence. And it should come up with the conclusion that if you wish to have an efficient and well-organized system of public and private relationships, the environmental easement has to go, and the tax dollars have to come in. At that particular point, the political process will completely transform itself for the better. There will be more prudent decisions as to what should be taken and not taken, and there'll be far lower expenses associated with the operation of the particular project. So what's not to like about a system which does not involve the environmental easement or the environmental mitigation issue, which will give you more accurate results at a lower cost? And the tragedy in this particular case is that the largest structural issue that looms behind the whole doctrine of unconstitutional conditions was passed by in silence in the entire argument once it was clear that Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor had their way, that environmental mitigation is an established part of American law. It is one of the very, very many mistakes that have been made in takings law that should be corrected as forcibly and as emphatically and as soon as possible. Thank you. This is Richard Epstein speaking from the Hoover Institution, talking about the case of Koontz against the St. John's River Water Management District.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.